Welcome back to Making It Awkward. I'm your host, Jessica Wilson. Today is my last installment about the Examination and Washington Post article titled, As Obesity Rises, Big Food and Dietitians Push Anti-Diet Advice. We'll hear from two people profiled in the article, Jay Rashan, whose story framed the article, and anti-diet dietitian Kara Harbstreet, whose social media video of her eating Cheerios was critiqued in the article. Hopefully, this episode will humanize them both and have them not just be the women in the article. You'll first hear from Jay and her journey to anti-diet, what she experienced and why she decided to leave and find a new path. She reached out to me for an interview after hearing my episode with Sasha, and I'm so grateful. You'll then hear from Kara, who summed up her work as doing PR for food. Kara and I first connected last month, and for this episode, she and I chatted about the responses she got from the general public and trolls, her views on the article, the anti-diet movement, and also a bit about the business side of social media. First, here's Jay. Jay, welcome to the show.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here.
I'm so glad you reached out. I'm so grateful for this time.
Well, I'm so grateful that you want to talk. I'm so excited to be here.
So first, how are you doing? That felt kind of like a shot to fame, even though you had already been on YouTube.
Yeah, I'm doing well. It's been a very positive experience, really. Just feeling good. The article came out the week of my 52nd birthday, like literally the day after my birthday. So that was interesting. And by and large, the response has been positive. It's been interesting. It's been a ride. Yeah. So yeah.
What did you think about the final article itself?
I thought it was great. I thought it talked about a very important issue. I don't think, unless you're on YouTube or social media a lot and like kind of work in like public relations or the media, which is, I work in publishing and just the media in general. I've worked in the entertainment industry as well. I don't think people are aware just how much money talks behind the scenes and how much it can be so easy for industry to hijack a really well-intentioned movement or hashtag or, you know, people who are out there genuinely wanting to help people. And then it just, you know, it can be pretty insidious. And sometimes I feel like with social media, people see a real face behind the camera and they don't really think for even a second that, oh, big industry is paying this person to tell me to do something. Even if they put sponsored on there, you kind of, you know, it's very small. You know, you see this person as somebody that you trust or that seems trustworthy, whether it's because you like their personality and they seem genuine or because they have good credentials to back them, you know. I just don't know that people are very aware of how much big food, and I mean, let's face it too, big pharma, you know, is just weaving itself so cleverly into our psyche. And to me, now growing up in the 80s, you were always bombarded by ads. That's life. We've always been bombarded by food ads, but never have we seen this extra layer where it feels like real people serving up information to you that you don't realize is actually technically an ad. So I love the article for exposing that part of what's going on. You know, I think it's important that people are made aware of it. And I liked being a part of that story, you know, just relaying how it has definitely muddied the waters for me to make good, you know, decisions that align with my goals, you know, in my life and for my health. So
when you found anti-diet, were you looking for medical information or was it like mental health or was it just like general food things?
I just got sick of dieting. I just got sick of it. I had just I had just been on probably the strictest diet of my life at the time. Mm-hmm. I had gone keto. Now, some people, this works great. It's fine. I don't judge anybody's choices. It's a strategy. It's a food plan, right? Well, it worked great for me at first, but then it kicked in. Like, I believe I had an eating disorder in high school. I'm pretty sure I was atypical anorexic. Mm-hmm. I think I was winding my way down toward being emaciated, but I never got there. Thanks to that wonderful pastry shop I started working for, probably saved my life, because I was eating like pastry and cheesecake and stuff, and it might have actually kept me from ever becoming emaciated. But I was doing some pretty shady things to myself to be thin, and it felt like that's what I was doing with the keto diet. Like, I started to recognize the thought processes. I was like, oh crap, wait a second. This is not a food plan anymore. This is becoming not good. And I didn't have like a good relationship with a doctor yet at the time. I did not have a therapist at the time. I actually didn't even have healthcare at the time. So I felt like my options were pretty limited. So I was like, I recognize that this is bad. I'm barreling down diet culture. Like, I was on the diet culture side big time and engaging in super restrictive behaviors. I recognized it and I knew that that wasn't good. And I believe I just looked up like how to stop binge eating. I remember, like, I can see my TV in front of me. I watch YouTube on my TV. So I can literally see my TV and looking up those words. And that's when the rabbit hole hit, the anti-diet rabbit hole, which is a really valid and great rabbit hole, because diet culture is real and it is toxic. But I didn't realize I was stumbling into some pretty bad advice on the anti-diet culture side of it, So I followed some advice that was meant more for people who were emaciated and on that side of the spectrum, and not for binge eaters and people who would wind up in a bad state of health because they're just eating way, way, way too much. And not even just eating way too much, but in a really bad mindset while you're eating way too much. You know, that to me is more what was not good about it. So that's really what kind of brought me to it, was I just wanted relief from dieting and omitting entire food groups and thinking about it all the time, So at first it was very refreshing to have somebody say, hey, go out and buy your fear foods, bring them into the house and go crazy, eat them all, because for several months, maybe about 6 months, I had been eating like no carbs. So, I mean, that's wonderful, but it got almost manic, it got almost manic, the amount of food that I was eating to heal my body from what I was doing before. So it's like that pendulum swing was just, it was extremes. It was just extremes, That's where I discovered it and kind of where it led me.
Oh, this is super.
I don't know if that story sounds familiar.
No, I've never heard that before. Yes.
Well, I'm sure you have not.
What you're saying right now really impacts me as far as the not having healthcare, not having access to these messages and this one-on-one support, and how social media and YouTube can fill in those gaps, and also
and how it can also
flatten the message. So if someone were talking about fear foods with their client, they might check in like a week or two rather than just like go off and do these things unsupported and tune in next week
or
however for the next installment.
That is such a good point. Because recently, so then I wound up getting into a place where I was able to afford I'm on Obamacare. I'm on the Affordable Care Act. But it still requires paying a premium. And I was so broke, starving artist level broke, that I got on the Affordable Care Act and I was finally able to afford a therapist. And I went to her for eating disorders and, that kind of stuff and everything really, but she specialized in eating disorders. Mm-hmm. And I sought her out because I was still really struggling with all mm-hmm. of it. And now that I know how it all works, I know, like what you just said here, she would have checked in on me. Like I would have gone back in and she would have said, okay, which fear foods did you get? Mm-hmm. And I would have told her, she would have said, where were you in your head when you ate them? How did it feel? You know, how much of it did you eat in one sitting? How did that feel? Mm-hmm. You know, and we would, but that's not really there mm-hmm. unless you want to pay for their coaching sessions. But I don't even think their coaching sessions are like that. You know what I'm saying? I think it's just a downloadable PDF to read. You know what I mean? I don't know. For $97. I don't know.
You know? That's a fantastic. So, point. Yes, absolutely. Wow.
Yeah.
Something else that you said that struck me before we got started is who the people speaking the loudest are and what we're reasonably able to assume about their experiences and the sizes that they have been and how you were thinking about that as a fatter person.
What struck me in when I fell into that, like, you know, recover from binge eating disorder rabbit hole and the anti-diet, you know, don't diet, just throw your scale away type, you know, influencers and YouTubers, mm-hmm. they were all very, very thin. Mm-hmm. They, even after being recovered,
right. even after they gained weight, they were still thin.
Even after they gained weight, they're in straight sized mm-hmm. bodies for sure. Mm-hmm. You know, they're so, but what that does is it gives somebody who wants to lose weight a lot of hope that they're going to mm-hmm. heal and be in that thinner body or just be in a normal, you know, not like, it gives you hope. It's like false advertising mm-hmm. in a way, you know, because I am quite certain mm-hmm. most of these people have never been in a fat, they've never been fat mm-hmm. ever. Mm-hmm. They do not know what it feels like to be 100+ pounds overweight. They don't know. They don't know what it's like being 52 and, you know, about 100 pounds overweight and what it does to your knees and just your energy levels, all of it, you know? And if they knew even for one day what it's like to feel that way, I don't think they'd be telling me to eat, unconditionally mm-hmm. and throw my scale away and not pay any attention to it and just whatever you want, you know? It feels really irresponsible and unrealistic. It feels like magical thinking. So, and I'm a magical thinker. So, you know, now I'm more of a science-based thinker, but at the time, you know, like, and I feel like, I don't know. I didn't plan on mentioning this, but it's been interesting to watch Oprah lately mm-hmm. with her Ozempic, mm-hmm. like, infomercial,
yes,
basically, mm-hmm. because I truly believe that she's a magical thinker mm-hmm. too. And kind of the mm-hmm. people that she has supported throughout her life and the concepts that she's kind of platformed, mm-hmm. I feel like a lot like me. I relate to her so much because I feel like I chased after fad diet, quick fix stuff, you know, mm-hmm. instead of addressing what is making me turn to food to cope with stuff, mm-hmm. you know, like, so the magical thinking aspect of it can really suck you in and really give you false hope. Mm. And really just, it's so exhausting, mm-hmm. you know, to be thinking about yeah. it all the time to the degree that you do. Mm-hmm. And most of those anti-diet influencers, I don't think there was a single one that I had watched that knew what it was like to be in a fat body. Mm-hmm. Not a single mm-hmm. one of them. So, I mean, I don't know. What does that say? You know, I don't know. Are they qualified to give us advice? Mm. I feel like we're missing something mm-hmm. here because even my in-person therapist, she was on the anorexic side of the spectrum. Sick for her was not eating enough. Mm-hmm. Sick for me was eating too much. So how could I really take her advice, you know, like, and I feel like it's missing. I don't know that there are people out there qualified to help people like me who want to lose weight in a healthy and sane way and just get back to what is my natural weight. I don't even know what my natural weight is right now. And that's okay. Yeah. I have an idea maybe of what it might be, but I know it's not the BMI. Right. I know it's not that, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. But I know it's not this. And I just feel like there's something missing in healthcare with registered dietitians that understand the difficulty of being fat, the kind of the fat that you don't want to be. Because I want to make it clear that to me, fat is not bad. It's not wrong. But when you know that you don't want to be this level of fat, you know that your body, you want to heal your body of something that's gone amiss, you know? So I don't even know what the answer is, you know, to getting more people in healthcare. I don't know, maybe I need to be a dietitian or something.
I mean, you probably won't make that much money.
I don't know, because I feel like there's a big hole, you know, there's just something really missing,
yes,
you know, in healthcare and in that. What do you think?
Like in my head, I'm going through my Rolodex of fat dietitians who have a history of eating disorder. But I think a lot of it continually is that then folks are the ones who are platformed.
Oh my God, I think you're right.
So there are fat people definitely out there. A lot of fat people were many of the first in the Health at Every Size movement. I think about how Health at Every Size really picked up steam when people like Christy Harrison started speaking about it. And a lot of fat people were grateful for that to have happened. And it was in a moment that I had stepped out of the eating disorder field because it gotten like really weird. Step back in. I was like, who is this Christy Harrison person? And why is everyone listening to her when she's saying the same thing that fat activists have said forever? But I think you're seeing and we're seeing all of these thin women is because people are just listening to them.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, I don't know that she's ever been obese either, or fat. Sorry.
It's okay.
I don't know that she's ever been fat. To me, she looks like she's naturally thin. I don't know. But I actually got into her. Like I found her podcast on YouTube, like Food Psych was her first podcast. Mm-hmm. And yeah, the algorithm served that thing up to me. It knew. it knew. It always knows. And I listened to her a lot. And again, it was very like refreshing. Like a lot of it was it was nice to listen to. It was a relief to listen to that. But at the same time, it was like, I don't know that you are really talking to me because I want to lose weight. I don't want to be as fat as I am. I don't mind that I may be fat, you know, but I know that this is not the weight I want to be and that I know this is not my natural weight. I put too much of it on when I was in a really bad headspace. So the same way I lost so much when I was in a bad headspace, you know, I need to be somewhere in the middle of that. So for me, while Christy's podcast had a lot of great guests on so much that I could relate to, so much, and it felt very refreshing. Mm-hmm. I also felt like the advice was more for people that just are perfectly happy being fat and just, you know, whatever. And that's great. Like it would be great to be like, but that's not who I am. But the thing is, it kind of is me because I'm not going to be the BMI. That's bullshit. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to be that, you know, I know that. I'm probably still going to be in a fat body is what I'm trying to say. Mm-hmm. And I'm okay with it. I'm okay with it. Like I'm perfectly fine with it, but how to lose weight in a way that doesn't make you go crazy is what I'm missing. Like, I don't know. Thinking out loud.
Super helpful.
So,
I really appreciate it. Is there anything else that you would like people to know about you or your story or this experience for you?
What I would want to share with everybody is that for me, my relationship with food and my existence in my body had more to do with my mind, my mental health, I kind of had it backwards. I thought, if I just lose the weight, my mental health will get better. Mm-hmm. And that is so not mm-hmm. true. I got on the right medication finally. My doctor she is so like just gentle and wonderful and on my team, and I trust her. And she was like, we just need to get your head straightened out. And she said, I'm convinced that if we get you on the right mental health medication, the food stuff is going to be a pretty low roar, pretty dull, you know. And so sure enough, it's true. Like my food kind of craziness, the way I felt just so anxious. And you know what, too? My anxiety about being fat and being scared all the time of having a heart attack or a stroke or some event because I'm fat, even that has kind of gone down a little because I'm on the right mental health meds. So it's kind of helped me to chill out and enjoy the process instead of like being in a dang hurry to get it all off. Like, I just want to be gentle and have a lifestyle that supports the type of activities that I really want to do. Without a doubt, the mind, I feel like, is such an important part of the mind and body. We're connected. We're holistic beings. Right. And we try to disconnect it all the time. And I mean, maybe that's fundamentally where it all kind of goes astray. You know, trying to disconnect that, you know, and spirit too, mm-hmm. you know.
Totally agree.
You know, if like me, you're having a difficult time with food and you're turning to it a lot and don't feel like it's a great place to be, you know, it could be that it could be the brain. It could be, you know, the brain needs a little rewiring or some help, somebody to talk to.
Yes. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I'm so glad you reached out. I really appreciated
it. Oh my gosh, this has been wonderful. You are fantastic.
Oh, thank you.
I love your show. Now I have your show to listen to too. So now I've got a new podcast addiction.
Well, be sure to give me any critical feedback you may have.
I will.
I will trust you to do
so. No, I've loved everything. I've loved everything I've been listening to. So yeah. Yeah. Thank you. You're wonderful. Thank you for letting me come on here and not be the woman from the article and be Jay.
Right? Who we keep talking about. I know. Oh, it's rough.
It's okay. It's funny. It's just really bizarre. It's strange. Yeah. So thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for coming on. Thanks again to Jay for coming on the show and sharing her story with all of us. Now you'll get to hear from Kara Harbstreet, one of the anti-diet dietitians mentioned in the most recent article and in the first article about dietitians that both Sasha and Clara Nosek had referenced. That first article from, again, The Examination and Washington Post is titled, "The Food Industry Pays Influencer Dietitians to Shape Your Eating Habits." The subtitle says it all. Registered dietitians are being paid to post videos that promote diet soda, sugar, and supplements on Instagram and TikTok. The article details how dietitians do commercials for food companies and food industry lobbying groups. The article discusses that these dietitians don't always disclose their partnerships or do so in a way that is clear to the public. What was not said in the article was that the dietitians were misrepresenting the science, because they weren't. Everything they said lined up with the current research and what was being put out even by the WHO. In addition, the information on destigmatizing candy and ice cream so that people don't crave them holds up in my 15 plus years of clinical experience for folks in my community and amongst my colleagues. The article did lead to attention from government regulators. The Federal Trade Commission sent warning letters to American Beverage, as well as the Canadian Sugar Institute and 12 health influencers. The FTC flagged, quote, nearly 36 social media posts that it said failed to clearly disclose who was paying the influencers to provide artificial sweeteners or sugary foods, end quote, from the follow-up article. So people needed to be more explicit when they were doing commercials. To follow up from that, in this interview, Kara and I talk a bit about social media commercials and why they work so well. And with that, here's my interview with Kara. Kara, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. Do you want to tell us a bit about yourself before we get started?
Oh, I'd love to. So you know that I'm Kara. I'm the dietitian behind Street Smart Nutrition.
Yes.
So that's my brand, all my social handles, my website, and I'm based in Kansas City. I lived here, you know, grew up here, been here for years, and have, you know, done a number of different things as a dietitian, but came back here to do my internship and master's program. Started working in corporate wellness initially, had kind of a short stint in retail, also worked clinical, and then eventually took it to private practice. So that's what really evolved into the work that I do today, which is still a teeny tiny bit of private practice, but then a lot more with nutrition communication. So when people ask our favorite question, what do you do? I basically say it's like PR for food. You know, we're just talking about nutrition messaging across a variety of platforms and fully self-employed, which gives me a lot of flexibility in what I'm able to do.
Awesome. So how are you doing now this month?
I appreciate that question. I'm doing well, thankfully. I think had you asked that same question, maybe we'll say 5 months ago.
Yeah, let's.
Different story.
Are you open to saying a bit more about what you experienced after the first article?
This was like nothing I have ever gotten before or since. Early on, I mean, that first article went out, I think on like a Wednesday morning, like a weekday morning. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's the first notification that I got, was just these pings and, you know, seeing comments kind of trickle in. So I thought, oh, okay, that article must be here. You know, trolls are no, you know, new thing. I think if you've been online for any amount of time, you've gotten the occasional negative comment, just like super nasty out of the blue. You get that notification that pops up and you're like, whoa, okay, I wasn't prepared for that. But mm-hmm. typically when stuff like that has happened in the past on a much smaller scale, it's like a matter of hours, maybe days before mm-hmm. it really fades out. But this, if anything, just seemed to gain momentum. So just the frequency of these types of comments, but also like the persistence of it. Like people were really going out of their way to make sure I saw what they had to say about it. So this was one of the first times that I was getting direct emails. You know, people were finding my contact information. It was very disruptive at first. Mm-hmm. And then with just the growing volume of it, mm-hmm. it, you know, it just kind of wears you down. I had some really long conversations with some of the other dietitians who were also featured in that article. And, you know, we were just checking in with each other like, hey, good morning. How was it for you today? You know, I saw what you were dealing with. I hope that doesn't last much longer, you know, that type of thing. You know, people are not shy about letting you know that not only have they not bothered to get to know anything about you or your work, mm-hmm. but they also really don't care what kind of impact their words say. So they just drop that trolling comment and they move on with their day. But then there's another one coming, you know, to just immediately fill that void that they left. That was a pretty low point as far as just personal and professional sense of self, but thankfully have had a lot of support, had a lot of great conversations, and also very thankful that, you know, I'm able to keep working.
Yeah.
You know, that's a big piece of just being self-employed. You kind of ride that roller coaster of the ebb and flow. And when it's busy, it's super busy. And so far this year, things have been super busy, which is another upside. You know, I don't have time to really dwell on it and really think on it.
So we mentioned the first article, and I am curious, when you opened up the most recent one, what were your thoughts about the article itself?
Similar to the first one, we knew it was coming, but just wasn't sure exactly when. And my initial thought was like, there I am again. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't featured nearly as prominently. Mm-hmm. You know, my full name was not above the fold. You did have to scroll a ways to get into the article, but they put a full video. You know, all of my posts are public. It's public domain. That's why they're out there. But I was like, there's my face again in the Washington Post. Mm-hmm. So I was bracing, you know, just like I said, that experience of the fallout from the first one. And there was a big difference. I will say for that next one, the one that was really more anti-diet focused, handful of comments here and there, but nothing at all like that first one. I mean, that was the instance that I would have expected, where after a few hours, certainly a few days, you know, it was more or less everyone's moved on.
Interesting. And then reading through the entire thing, what did you think of like the substance of the article or the argument made.
Yeah. Another just tally in the column of like a willful misunderstanding and like a very blatant misrepresentation. I think for a number of things, right? Like the article wasn't just about anti-dietitians. No. It wasn't just about General Mills or working with industry. It wasn't just about the impact of influencers who are talking about the, like, it's all the things. Mm-hmm. So to weave the storyline the way that they did, it felt like they were leaving a breadcrumb of sorts to almost, I don't want to say force the reader to arrive at the same conclusions, but certainly kind of like leading them towards that. I think there's a number of different ways that they could have been much more detailed about what, in fact, an anti-diet approach to eating is. It seemed very limited as far as like the anecdotal or really personal experiences with people in that space. And I think they really painted with some wide brushstrokes to kind of imply that that was an experience that anybody would have or was likely to have. When in reality, I disagree that that's the case.
Well, and also this, we're having this conversation as obesity is rising. So like the title to me is like actually the reason that obesity is rising. It's because of anti-diet dietitians saying cereal's not that bad. And so yeah, the title poll in and of itself just was wild, a wild choice to me.
Yeah. It also kind of felt like they were backing into that conversation by linking it so strongly to the first article. Like we said, they did point pretty heavily to that association, you know, dietitians working with industry. Oh, that must be a contributing factor. Mm-hmm. Let's follow that line of thinking a little bit further. Mm-hmm. And here we are. Anti-diet dietitians are the problem. But again, painting with such wide brushstrokes seems to imply that there's like this cohesive, like concerted effort to do that. And again, that's not been my experience working as one with other ones who do the same work.
It kind of feels personal to me in a way that I don't understand as far as you and anti-diet dietitians. Does that come up amongst the folks that you've talked to?
It's crossed my mind. I think, you know, it's a strange situation. I mean, I completely own the fact that I am both someone who follows anti-diet frameworks in my personal and professional work as a dietitian. Mm-hmm. And I'm also someone who openly works with industry, you know, works with these paid partners as an independent contractor. You know, that is the bulk of my business. Mm-hmm. And that's always been super transparent. So I do think like that Venn diagram of dietitians who do one and dietitians who do the other has very shallow overlap. And I have a hunch that I may be one of the few, if not the only dietitians who either participated in both campaigns or has that overlap. It's interesting to me as well, because, you know, it got to feeling personal when I looked at the video they chose to embed. And at the time of the article being published, it had 93 likes. So that to me was a little bit like interesting choice there, because you seem to be implying that, you know, these anti-diet dietitians with these massive social media followings have this disproportionate influence and they're, you know, poisoning the minds of their audience. And it's like, seems to me like not many people even saw this in the first place.
Yeah. Sponsored posts are inherently buried also.
Yes. And we know the algorithms do that intentionally because now that these platforms are all pay to play, I think that's another piece I wish would have come to the surface, you know, either earlier on or at all, is that there's a very real disincentive for people to properly disclose. And in my experience, having been like chronically online for years now, is that by and large, dietitians are overly cautious and over disclose. So it again feels like incompatible positions. Like one, anti-diet dietitians are so influential. They've got this massive reach. This is like common vocabulary at this point.
Yeah.
And also we're going to show you a video that has less than 100 likes because nobody ever really saw it.
Right. But over 10,000 followers. So this 92, like what it sounds like is 10,000 people are getting this message about how it's fine to eat cereal. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that is where it's all super interesting to me, so specific. And why is this the choice that people are making? Like when you're trying to address, we'll say, chronic diseases, this is the avenue, the choice that you've made. But I mean, hey, everybody likes a quick click, love clickbait articles. It's going to be great.
Yeah, the methodology was a little interesting to me as well, as far as just, like you said, you mentioned the 10,000 followers. So what, if you have fewer than that, say whatever you want. We're not going to put a microscope over you.
Yeah.
Or, you know, when we're talking about like total reach, you know, it's really tough to measure that. You know, you're not going to get any degree of like real accuracy as far as what that shared audience size is. But when you put it in the context of, okay, whatever they said, 9 million collective followers. Well, that's like a not nothing overlap there. Like there's a lot of followers following almost all of us that were featured and probably more.
So 92 again. It's a cause for alarm. Good, good. Yeah. Ugh. So what do you think made this article like end up on NPR and Fox News and all of these places? What do you think was so deeply disturbing or interesting to people?
My personal theory is that it was easy. Like we have that saying, like low hanging fruit. Well, if we're going to be talking about things like heart disease and health outcomes and these dangerous or harmful effects, the easiest connection to point to is what we individually personally eat. And so I don't think that one, the general public or news outlets, neither one of them are at the point where they're either ready or able to engage fully with what we as dietitians often talk about, which are all these other factors. So social determinants of health, like this big category umbrella term that you could take in numerous directions. You know, I think the health literacy is certainly part of it, but you also mentioned earlier the aspect about, you know, it's easy to get clicks when you have this really sensationalized headline. These fear-mongering tactics are really effective for capturing attention. And the reality of most of what I say about food and nutrition, you know, that the self-awareness is very high that it's not a super sexy message. Like I'm saying things like have a can of beans with dinner, or it's okay to have frozen vegetables. They're just as nutritious if that's easier, so you don't end up wasting your money. You know, those things are not nearly on the same playing field as what these recent headlines have alluded to. So I think that, yes, it captures attention, but it's also just easy. Like that's an easy story to like really sink your teeth into and just run with, and they just take off with it. So that's my theory behind it.
Yeah. So in the context of what you were just talking about, what does anti-diet like mean to you, and has that changed ever, you know, in the last month since all of this has been happening?
Yeah. It's so funny. I do still have anti-diet dietitian in my bio.
I know.
We're working that SEO so that people might find me.
Right.
Yeah. Anti-diet to me, I did not come into like my early career as a dietitian with any like concept of that. You know, I didn't get any of this in undergrad.
No.
Certainly not in my internship or master's program the way that new grads might. And so for me, it was like this slow introduction over like the first few years that I was working. But thankfully, I was learning directly from the sources. You know, like I did read Intuitive Eating, the book, instead of learning about it through Instagram. Like I did have peers who were already active in that body liberation work and fat activism, who had personal connections to, at the time, you know, leadership within ASDA. So my, you know, introduction to that was by way of, this is a fundamentally different set of beliefs, values, worldviews, and this is a liberatory movement. So I think because of the prevalence of how all of this anti-diet stuff has now, you know, been dragged out through social media, a lot of those fundamental shifts in beliefs, values, and worldviews gets boiled down to like a really weird version of it. Some of the analogies, like, you know, wellness culture is like diet culture light. And, you know, they're not really engaging or like interacting with some of these other aspects, like the liberatory movements and some of the truly radical things that have been at play. Mm-hmm. You know, again, I live in such a multi-privileged body. I don't have that same lived experience of being fat or having gone through weight cycling or any of that. But my understanding of it has always been through that lens versus, oh, this is just, you know, a pretty easy, you know, very palatable way to like heal from my own personal body image issues.
So were you or have you used anti-diet or all of that business to heal from it yourself?
Yeah. So for me, my background, I came up through sports. So playing, you know, volleyball and running track all through middle school, high school, and then later at the collegiate level. I'm like very much that case study of like, oh, the girl who got into dietetics because she probably had an eating disorder, you know, was not diagnosed at the time, like never had a formal diagnosis, but definitely engaged in like really problematic things as far as compensatory exercise and like body image stuff and all of this on like a very interpersonal level, which again is much, much different than experiencing that same degree of societal, you know, bigotry and stigma and bias and oppression that you would if you were in a larger or fat body. So it was helpful to me, especially the pieces around like satisfaction and just like that permission to eat things that you prefer. Also joyful movement. Like I remember that being one of the principles of intuitive eating that I was so attracted to, but I actually kind of struggled with the longest because of that history with athletics and sports. So yeah, I mean, to answer your question, it was helpful for me, but you know, it wasn't until a few years in that I was able to just, again, like kind of back up and start to question and criticize like, all right, even though it was helpful for me, like, would it be helpful for everyone? And that's where like some of the very vocal criticisms that I think are certainly valid and really fair about how much privilege it takes to fully engage with intuitive eating. Like how much privilege does it take to ditch diets? You know, that was something that I certainly did not start out with in the beginning.
As it was important to you and has been to many people, what do you think about the flattening, say, of the message or then using it to advertise food products and other things?
Yeah, I find it super interesting. I'll kind of start maybe with the latter part of it, just because that immediately pops to mind. I still don't know that this is something that food brands or food companies fully engage with because it's like trendy and popular. I think because it's trendy enough, like they're a business, they're a corporation, they're in it to sell food. And that's, you know, what they're going to do by any means necessary. So if it means that they start to market to that demographic, well, guess what? Intuitive eaters still buy food. Like intuitive eaters still eat and stock their pantry and put food in the fridge. So I think for that reason, it makes sense, but it's no different than saying we're going to target any other kind of like niche population out there and like drive some messaging their way. As far as like the very, you know, flattening, watering it down type of effect that we're seeing, I see, again, like the people I've learned from and like the resources that I still follow, you know, they've all been pointing to that parallel of like, this is what happened with like the body positivity movement, where it started out as this very, you know, seemingly radical movement that then turned into, well, here I am on Instagram contorting my body to show you that I also have cellulite. Like that's kind of the analogy of like, if that's what that is for body positivity, what we're now seeing is that for anti-diet and intuitive eating.
Yeah. And do you think that with the ads or anything else that you're participating in that?
Well, what's, I think, surprising to a lot of people is when I do this type of partnership work, they don't tell us what to say. You know, I'm still saying it the way that I believe to be true based on my understanding of the nutrition science, my experience with the flavor and taste and preparation of whatever that food is, and then what I think my audience knows me for. The same tone, the same, you know, references, all of that stuff is kind of interwoven throughout. And I think the misconception with partnered work is that, oh, they give you a script, you read from it, you have no participation in the process or the editing. And while I think that could be true for other partnerships and other influencers who don't have the training and knowledge that dietitians do, but again, that's not been my experience for all of the numerous partnerships I've done across the food industry.
Got it. Something that Jay had mentioned was it seems different than like a television ad or an ad in another place, because on social media, we literally like bring people into our homes. There was a strong like parasocial relationship with like the Oprahs and people in that sense. So maybe not ads, but like clearly Oprah was advertising, you know, products, as was Dr. Oz and his raspberry ketones. And that is a different parasocial relationship than what I think we have put on social media. Do you think that that influences people's strong reactions?
What I've always seen to be true with social media is like to have a sounding board with anybody, like to exert influence, great or small, people have to pay attention to you. And sometimes the easiest way to get people to pay attention to you is being relatable and likable. Like that's what some of these Instagram coaches and TikTok coaches,
totally. And, be a person. You know,
there's entire coaching programs around how to be or pretend to be more likable, more relatable.
Correct.
So with these parasocial relationship, I think there's two primary things that rise to the surface for me. One, it's that like we mistake ourselves into thinking, well, because I relate to this person, they must also relate to me. When really that's like a one directional, like very one-sided type of dynamic. I think the other is that, you know, for all of these assumptions about, oh, well, I know them, I like them, I therefore must be able to trust them. Mm. Like the trust element, I think that's what gets people really up in arms for some of the, you know, not just in this case, obviously we're talking about what, you know, came after these articles, but people get really easily offended when, you know, you don't follow the pattern that they might have expected. It's interesting. I think another piece that hasn't come up yet about why so many people seek out this type of information online is because you're not hearing about intuitive eating or anti-diet approaches from the larger healthcare system, which is probably why you might be interested in that in the first place. Mm-hmm. Like if you do have a concern about your weight or your health and you start sort of this self-exploratory process, it's completely self-guided. And we know that the internet can be this deep, deep hole mm-hmm. of endless profiles and personalities to engage with. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of it is because, one, dietitians haven't done a great job of letting it be known, here's how you can find us and work with us. But then also, like I said, with health education, so much of it remains so weight-centric mm-hmm. that if you decide to sort of disengage with that version of it, what are you left with? Like, where are you going to turn to? Probably the path of least resistance is that smartphone in your hand. Mm-hmm.
Is there anything else that you want people to know or that you would like to share?
I appreciate that question too. Nobody's really asked up to this point. What's funny is, you know, I've had these conversations offline, but probably the one thing I would say is that, you know, if you think that the body of work I do is limited to just talking about the science of aspartame or vitamin D and cereals, like there's a lot more. Like, you know, I'm working with produce groups and trade organizations and individual farmers. It's funny that the Washington Post never seemed to single out the time that I, you know, worked with mushrooms or, you know, eggs or seafood, you know, these foods that have, you know, the health halo. If anyone's familiar with that phenomenon, it's like, those aren't making the front page. Like they're not putting that in this article about the influence of dietitians. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we have to, I think, also be really critical and question, well, why is it that they honed in on these specific campaigns or these specific topics when we forget the fact that dietitians aren't just qualified to talk about the science and safety of one ingredient, they're actually qualified to talk about all of them. And they do, at least in my case, I try to. So I think that's one thing, you know, another big criticism that came out of it was, well, it seems like this is just people being mad that dietitians are making more money.
Yes.
You know, clinical dietetics, like it's no secret, you don't make a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And for me, at one time, I was on a single income and clinical dietetics would not have allowed me to pay debts or, you know, buy a house mm-hmm. or, you know, get a functioning car. You know, those are really real necessities that, you know, it's a privilege and I'm really fortunate to have those things now. But a lot of it is because I don't work clinical dietetics anymore. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when we talk about like falling out of line, you know, a lot of the first article especially seemed to be questioning, well, who does she think she is, you know, working with some of these campaigns or making money in a different way that's so non-traditional. I think that's kind of another like adjacent issue, is that, you know, dietetics is a predominantly, you know, female-led field.
Interesting. I want to express some compassion and say thanks for going through this again.
No, I do really appreciate that. I mean, I think that's totally fine. I mean, I've always decided, like, my line in the sand is like, I'll be as open and transparent as I am like legally allowed to be. Like, send me a message on Instagram. It's not guaranteed that I see it because I get so many things in my inbox. Yeah. But like, I understand it's confusing. Like, people don't know what I do, and I'm happy to talk about it.
I really appreciate you coming on, not really rehashing, but still living through it yet again as it continues to live on. So I appreciate you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thanks again to Kara for coming on the show.
What a series. I'll start by being so grateful to Sasha, Clara, Jay, and Kara for coming on and talking about the article and their thoughts on anti-diet overall. Sasha, I appreciate your time and willingness to be in conversation. Clara, I appreciate your deep dives into arguments and receipt gathering and your ability to distill the big picture into simple truths. Jay, I appreciate you sharing your story with all of us and showing us how these flattened messages land and also why people seek them out. And Kara, I appreciate your openness in describing why and how you do your work. I'll share some things that I learned and some things I'm still questioning. I learned that journalists want to change individual behaviors more than they want to change the eating environment and reaching those who don't read their publication. I learned that it's really hard for the news media to hold multiple truths. I learned that no one is above punching down. I learned that what the Washington Post and I think are, quote, dangerous claims about nutrition are vastly different and illustrate a difference between those who have studied the topic in depth and those who have just scratched the surface of the research without context. I learned that asking questions about systemic public health concerns isn't sexy enough, and that a months-long deep dive into social media hashtags is the way for publications to get clicks and giggles. I learned more reasons why people look to social media for medical advice. And then there are questions that I still have. Like, why do we think Evelyn Tribole and Elise Resch founded Intuitive Eating and didn't co-opt it from liberation spaces themselves and cultural communities to give it then 10 steps, like challenge the food police and charge people for books, certificates, courses, and consultations? And then, can anti-diet actually be radical if food corporations are interested in being associated with those who talk about it openly? And I really don't know about this one. If something can be co-opted for money, was it truly liberatory to begin with? I also want to know why people aren't talking about who spoke in the loudest about anti-diet in the last 5 years. I'm curious about whether anti-diet took off because there was a promise that if people started to eat the foods they really wanted to eat, would they then look like the influencers who were anti-diet? And lastly, I want to know who the journalists will be to finally do the deep dive into poor neighborhoods, into food apartheid, sustainable farming, income inequity, access to healthcare, building policies, race, and the fact that America functions by maintaining an underclass that demonizes easily accessible foods.
And none of this, I repeat, none of this is why people are getting fatter, chronic disease rates are increasing, and people are choosing to eat cereal. So, people, what are we doing and why are we doing it? One thing is certain, capitalism always wins. But again, that's not a sexy enough message. Whew, this series has been fun. And speaking of fun, I truly appreciate your reviews of the show. A recent one said, quote, if you've ever wondered what it would be like if The Office had a baby with an introspective yet delightfully awkward dietitian, this podcast is your answer. The same reviewer said the show makes people laugh, cringe, and nod all at the same time. I hope the above is true for you. Until next time. Sprinkle some Splenda on your Cheerios and make it awkward, friends. This has been Making It Awkward. I'm your host, Jessica Wilson, a registered dietitian nutritionist who doesn't get ads yet and whose podcast is supported in part by Patreon members. You can help us out by rating and reviewing the show and keeping our fearless editor, Jen Jacobs, working on this project. You can watch these podcast episodes on YouTube and Spotify. This is a production of The Body Politic Podcast.